The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Stand to Reason, and so glad you're with me. Looking forward to talking with you over the next 3 hours on anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Of course, at Stand to Reason, we are standing to reason for classical Christian values and classical Christian thinking, and my goal is to demonstrate that classical Christianity is worth thinking about. And so if you'd like to call in and ask a question or make a comment, weigh in, give me a piece of your mind, I'll respond by trying to do the same. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150. I'll give you those numbers again. 1-800-227-5278 and 754-4150. Direct here in Costa Mesa in Southern California. You know, I'm a week late on what I'm about to tell you here, but it doesn't really matter. To me, it's really interesting. It has to do with Halloween. And most who are Christians have kind of made their peace one way or another with how they're going to deal with this. Many Christians are uncomfortable with Halloween, which we had last week, Wednesday, I guess, right? And which was also Reformation Day, which is also the Enforcer's birthday. Oh, by the way, that reminds me, there's a birthday today, which is my mother-in-law's. And we probably will be seeing her at the end of the show. She's down here near the studio with her son, spending some time with him. And she was born 1 week before the armistice was signed for the First World War. She was born during the First World War. I mean, she caught it by 7 days, right? But that would be 1918, which would make her 94 today. So our congratulations to Trova Melberg, our dear grandma in our home. She lives with us and makes a tremendous contribution to our life in the Kokel household. And by the way, many of you know about Trova because I took a video of her clearing brush on our property last year, and she's dragging it up the driveway. See, when I say 94 years old, you guys get the wrong picture about Trova Melberg. She's an old farm girl, and she's an old farm girl, you know. She's still farming on our place, basically, and she's doing it in a hearty manner. So she mows the lawn at our house. She trims the trees. She takes care of the garden, which is very large, and helps with the meals, makes a huge salad every single night that we have dinner at our home with all kinds of stuff in it. It's probably keeping me alive. My wife helps with the cooking, obviously, and so sometimes it's a group affair, but Grandma always makes her contribution and is continuing to do so. And she's like the Energizer Bunny. She's never going to stop, it looks like. So we're glad to have her around, and we hope that there's a lot more birthdays for Trova Melberg. I did mention, though, this October 31st was the Enforcer's birthday, and Trova is 94, and the Enforcer is not. and I'm just going to leave it at that. But back to the Halloween question, a lot of Christians have been uncomfortable because of its occultic connections, and as some think it's occultic origins. And there are all kinds of things you can read from different writers who've made contributions talking about the occultic origins of Halloween. And then there is a sense for many that if you participate in Halloween, then you're participating in the same, you know, you are somehow participating in the spirit of its origins, even though you don't hold those views. Just going through the motions is somehow makes you complicit in that, and I respect those who have a conscious issue like that. And I don't share that particular point. I think you can take something that had a meaning at a different time and redeem it in a certain sense. You can reinvest it with new meaning. You know, Paul himself said an idol is nothing. An idol is nothing. There are demons, but the idol is nothing. And so I don't think that there's anything inherent in some of these practices just because 500, 1,000 years ago, someone did the same thing with evil intent. But I've just discovered by reading an article by Angie Mosteller, who has written a fabulous book on Christmas traditions and backgrounds, and it's called, her company is Celebrating Holidays. It's an educational company dedicated to teaching the Christian roots of American holidays. I don't know what what the title of her book on Christmas is, but it's Mosteller, Mosteller. Great thing to get right about now if you want to talk about, you know, Christmas traditions coming up. I don't usually like to mention Christmas before Thanksgiving. All right, like 2 months ago, I saw Christmas stuff in Costco. I mean, it was before the 4th of July, it seemed like, and that's way too early for me. I don't want to look at stuff until Thanksgiving. But since I'm talking about this and she wrote the book, you might consider her book, which is a great one, on the origins of Christmas traditions in the background. Well, she's done this piece on the Christian origins of Halloween, and I've read through it, and it's very interesting because it turns out, at least according to her research, and some people have come up with other conclusions, so I'm just throwing this out as another point of view. But according to her research, Halloween, which is a blending of the words All Hallows and Eve, even or Ian, which refers to the evening before All Holy's Day or All Saints' Day, which is November 1st. So October 31st is the evening before All Holy's Day. And so this is where you get Halloween, Hallows Even, the night before. And this was in early church history, Christians would celebrate the heroes of the faith, the saints. And by the 7th century, All Saints' Day was celebrated annually throughout the Christian world. Now, they celebrated on a little different days, but the origin, no question, of All Saints' Day and its Eve, Halloween, was entirely Christian, according to her research. And the supposed connection to paganism came with the fact that the Roman Catholic Church moved the celebration of All Saints' Day to November 1st in the 8th century. Now, some people claim this was to kind of co-opt a kind of pagan celebration then, in this particular celebration, this holiday. Now, I used to always call it or pronounce it Samhain, because that's what it looks like, Samhain. But according to Mosteller, the actual pronunciation is Samhain. So there you have it. So I'll use Samhain. But if you've read before about Samhain, I'm talking about the same time, the same date, which was celebrated on the 31st. But she suggests several reasons to dispute that the moving of the date was to co-opt this Samhain day of the pagans. And part of it was that this was a practice of northern Celtic people, particularly in Ireland and Scotland, who had this holiday. But Rome is 1,500 miles away, and they changed the day of All Saints' Day. It's hard to believe that they're changing it because of something that's happening in Northern Ireland or Northern Scotland. It's not even clear that all of the gruesome things that people are associating with even Samhain Day, though it was pagan, was actually part of that enterprise. I mean, I think the phrase means like end of summer. And since there were no written records prior to that time for the Celts, it's hard to know entirely what they actually practiced on that pagan day and on that pagan holiday. apparently some researcher who had an interest in showing or demonstrating what he considered the pagan foundations of Christianity made a big deal about this. And when Sir James Frazier studied the practices of the Northern Celtic people and Hallowmas, which is a term that was used to describe the three-day period from October 31st to November 2nd. And he drew the conclusion that these were deeply pagan things that influenced Christianity. And apparently, according again to Angie Mosteller, this is where everybody else got the idea that Halloween had pagan roots. But she says that just simply cannot be substantiated. Now, she also points out in this article that, you know, modern Halloween celebrations, at least in our country, have lost all of their Christian character. And it should come as no surprise, she points out, that a holiday celebrating death would develop a dark and superstitious character among non-believers. Now, the Christians celebrated the death of their saints and their graduation to glory, as it were, and then celebrated their holy lives, All Saints Eve, or All Hallows Eve. But then when the secular world gets a hold of it, it gets dark and gruesome. And so many of those characteristics have been characteristic of Halloween since then. But her point is, this is not the way it was from the beginning. And so if it turns out that she's right on this, and that Halloween had Christian roots from the beginning, and even though the date was changed to October 31st, it doesn't change the Christian roots of it and the Christian purposes of it, and there was no pagan foundation to it at all, and not in all these details of Halloween that we think of, well, that might change the judgment of some Christians and how they might participate. I'll tell you, for us, we're kind of midway. My wife is still a little bit leery of carving pumpkins and putting lights in them because that, on her understanding, this goes back to some cultic thing that she's uncomfortable with, and fine. So we just put regular pumpkins out, like for harvest, and it looks great. Although I have to say, well, we went trick-or-treating in my pastor's neighborhood, and we let his house be the last stop, so we hung around there for a half hour and talked a bit. But we saw some of the coolest pumpkins carved on people's porches. It was amazing. There was a couple of pumpkins. Actually, we saw this picture. Three pumpkins, and there were a bunch of empty beer cans around it and beer bottles, and one... Well, you kind of have to picture this, but the one pumpkin had a bunch of pumpkin seed stuffing innards from the pumpkin kind of flowing out of its mouth to kind of give you an idea of the final result of Halloween levity and celebration, whatever. It's gross. It didn't look gross, though. It looked kind of clever. And anyway. Let's see, what else did I want to say about that? The final conclusion, of course, in this piece by Angie Mosteller is that rather than abandoning Halloween to the lost, let's reclaim it for God's glory. And we go trick-or-treating with the girls. We don't stay out very long, half an hour. We don't let them eat all the candy after they forget about it. We give it away or get rid of it or something like that. But it's a fun time for them, and they really enjoy it. If you looked at my Facebook, you saw my girls with their pumpkin bags on their heads. By the way, the book written by Angie Mosteller about Christmas is titled Christmas, Celebrating the Christian History of Classic Symbols, Songs, and Stories. So available on Amazon, of course, and you might want to take a look at that. I have another book written by someone else. I think I have both of these, but I had a great time last Christmas just reading these. In fact, I think I read some of them on the air. Once again, her title, Christmas, Celebrating the Christian History of Classic Symbols, Songs, and Stories, Angie Mosteller. So you might want to take advantage of that. Let's do this. I'm done a little early here in our segment. We can break and I can go to your calls. 1-800-227-5278. And if you're in the 714 area code 754-4150, 4 stand to reason.
Did God really say? It's the oldest temptation in human history, one that targets the authority of God's Word at its very foundation. Its modern rephrasing takes many forms, both in academia and in popular culture. Are the New Testament documents reliable? Have ancient biblical books been lost or suppressed by the early church? Are the words of the Bible just flawed human inventions? These questions introduce doubt at the point of contact between God and man, undermining the Christian's confidence in the words of Scripture. Even those secure in their affirmation of divine authorship must wrestle with similar questions. Did God really say to me? In other words, do the promises of Scripture apply to the individual Christian's life today or only to those originally addressed? How is one to understand and apply these biblical assurances? In this timely collection of essays called Ancient Words, Reflections on the Reliability and Proper Use of Scripture, Greg carefully addresses each of these issues, providing both solid evidence for the reliability of Scripture and a clear roadmap for how it should be read and applied. Greg's responses to these popular challenges to biblical authority will help reinforce your confidence in this trustworthy book. Go to Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org and get a copy of Ancient Words or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. When we read the Gospels or one of Paul's letters, can we be confident that 2,000 years later we have what they originally wrote? The answer is a clear yes, and all we have to do is point to the facts. Find out what those facts are in my Bulletproof podcast this month. Look for Bulletproof on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Speaking events, new resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Post comments and interact with STR staff and other like-minded Christians. You can find all our social media connections at str.org.
Greg Kunkel back with you on Stand to Reason, give you a piece of my mind, as I do every Sunday, from 2 until 5. Is that right? You know, we lost an hour, or I gained an hour, depending on how you count, last night. So I'm just I'm a little bit discombobulated right now. 1-800-227-5278. Did I say that already? And if you'd like to call in, we'll be glad to take your call and have a chat. And let's go. One of my favorite callers, Josh. Josh and Tom, is it Thompson, Maine? Is that Thomason, Maine? Hello, Josh.
Hello, Mr. Kunkel.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
You know, son, I was at a event last night and talking with some people who listened to the show, and they brought you and your brother up, and they said how much they enjoyed listening to you two call in and how much fun it was to hear you ask me tough questions.
Oh, wow.
So you're getting to be a little well-known around the Stand to Reason crowd.
Yeah.
Well, is it getting cold up there in Maine yet?
Yeah.
Has all those beautiful leaves fallen now, or is it still nice up there? No more leaves, huh?
No.
Did you have to rake them?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, what's on your mind, Josh?
Well, I was listening to Jay Warner Wallace a while back when he was sitting in for you.
Uh-huh.
And he said all lying is sin.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's true, even if you sin for a higher good, lie for a higher good,
mm-hmm.
is that still sinning?
Yeah, well, on this point, if we'll just take Jay Warner's comment at face value, I haven't actually talked to him about this, but I would not agree with him unless he's offering a generalization, lying is sin. But if he's trying to say that all lying is sin, and if lying is telling an untruth, then I would not, or being deceptive or deceitful in some material way, then I guess I don't agree with him on that particular point. Because it does seem, and it looks like you've done some thinking about this, there are times when you encounter a circumstance in which you are forced to do one of two things, and both of those things taken individually would be wrong. And in the circumstance where you have to do one or the other, this is called a moral dilemma, when you have to do one or the other, the appropriate thing is to do the thing that is the greater good. So it's conceivable to me, and I think there are some biblical examples to this, where in lying or deceiving, one accomplishes the greater good. And if in the lying and deceiving, one is accomplishing the greater good in a moral dilemma, then the person who does the lying and deceiving has done a right thing. Because the only other alternative was to not lie but tell the truth, and in the process of telling the truth, do a greater moral harm. Does that make sense to you so far?
Yep. Well, in like 1 Samuel 16:1-3, when told Samuel to go anoint David,
right?
Samuel said, "What if asks me where I'm going?" So and God said, "And go tell him
you're going to sacrifice." God told Samuel to anoint David. Samuel's concerned because he's going to think Saul will find out, and then Saul will go after Samuel. And so then God says, well, just tell him you're going to do a sacrifice. Now, in this particular situation, when I read the passage because I knew it was going to come up, I read before the segment, all God does is he establishes a plan that protects Samuel. And the plan is to use the sacrifice as a cover. But there's no lying that's going on in that situation because he does sacrifice. It says here, the Lord said, verse 2, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord, and invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and then I'll show you what to do. And verse 4, so Samuel did what the Lord said, and he came to Bethlehem, and the elders of the city came trembling to meet him, because they're afraid of him. He's a prophet. Do you come in peace? He said, yeah, I come in peace. I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. So I have every reason to believe he actually performed the sacrifice. But the sacrifice was being used as a cover so that Saul wouldn't find out that Samuel was going to anoint David. There's no deception there. There's no lying that's going on there, and on my read, at least, Josh. But there's just an act of covering one's tracks, you know, and which I don't see any problem with that.
So do you disagree with J. Warner Wallace?
If what he said, and he meant it the way you put it, that all lying is sin, then I don't agree with him. And it seems like, for example, and I'll give you a couple of examples. It seems like the case where the spies were hidden by Rahab in the book of Joshua, she had to lie to protect their lives. Now, these were God's people. And the alternative, or so it seems, to her lying is to give the spies up. Because they asked her, do you know where they are? And she said, yeah. I mean, she didn't know where they were. They were hiding under the haystack on a roof, I think. Mm-hmm. And she said, no, they already went out the other way. And so she gave them false information that distracted them from the men on her roof. But she did this because of her love for God, knowing that these were God's people. And she was now throwing her lot in with them. And indeed, she became part of the nation of Israel. Her life was spared in the destruction of Jericho, and she's actually on the genealogy of the Messiah. So she's like Jesus' great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother somewhere in the past like that. Now, as I read the text in Joshua and as I read the reference made, for example, in James 2 to her, it seems that, though in James, I don't know if the lying itself was mentioned, it says there, wasn't she showing her faith in God by hiding the spies? And hiding the spies entailed lying, because if she wasn't lying, she wasn't hiding them.
But isn't it it different with God because God can't sin?
Yes, but I don't think God was deceiving here or lying in this particular case, first of all, in the 1 Samuel case. And secondly, I don't think it was sin anyway when Rahab lied. See, if you presume that all lying is sin, then any act of deception is going to be immoral because all of those things are in a sense a kind of lying. But first we realize sometimes when you're in a circumstance of a moral dilemma and it's one or the other, then you have to do the greater good, and if lying is required in order to accomplish the greater good, then lying is the right thing to do. So,
okay. So
I'm not presuming that it's always sin. Have you ever read The Hiding Place about Corrie Ten Boom, or have your folks read it to you?
Yeah, I have.
Well, this is a remarkable story about a woman who lived in a culture with the Germans and Nazis where they were killing Jews. And she had a choice, that is, to sit quiet and obey the law and tell the truth and everything with regards to the Nazis and allow Jews to die, innocent Jews, or to set up an entirely deceptive system in which they were lying constantly about all kinds of things. They got extra ration cards through deception. The soldiers came and said, "Where are the Jews in the house?" And they said, "There are no Jews in the house," yet there were. They were under the floorboards in one case, and they were upstairs in the hidden room in the other. Yet it seems that in each one of these cases that Corrie Ten Boom did what was right, because she saved the lives of those innocent people, even though it turned out to require deception. Now, I want to make sure, Josh, that you understand that I am not trying to be soft on lying, like lying's not a big thing. I'm saying truth telling is really, really important. And when we talk with our own girls, 4 and 7, and they're each going to have a birthday in the next few weeks, we talk to them that they have to tell mommy and papa the truth. They're not in a position to be able to assess, you know, whether they're in a moral dilemma or not. We want to know the truth, and we want them truth telling to be a major, a central feature of their life, because we want to be able to trust them, and we want other people to be able to trust them, and we want people to yes to be yes and their no to be no, and just that kind of thing. And I'm sure this is the same way your parents have raised you and your brother. Yet at the same time, as you grow and you get into more complicated circumstances, you realize that because we live in a fallen world, we get thrust into odd situations where we have to make a choice between two things that in themselves we would never choose for, except for when we get in this very unique kind of circumstance called a moral dilemma. Remember, I'm not saying you should lie so that a greater good happens. That's not what I'm saying. Because that then becomes a justification for all kinds of things that probably aren't in the long run good. I'm saying that when you are thrust, you are stuck in a circumstance where you have to make one of two choices and both of them would be wrong, then you choose the greater good. And in choosing the greater good, that is saving the life by lying, for example, then you've done the right thing. And in fact, I think that the lying in that circumstance was morally required. If Corrie Ten Boom had Jews hidden in her house, and the Germans came to her house, and she did not lie about the fact that they were hidden in the house, and told the truth and gave them up for execution, then I think she would have done the wrong thing. She would have done the wrong thing by not lying in that unusual and peculiar circumstance.
Okay.
So, I think you're following this really well, and I'm glad, but it's really important to me that you understand that I'm not being soft on truth-telling. I'm not just acting like it doesn't matter. But when really, really important and weighty things are in the balance, and it's one or the other, there are times when you have to do things that you ought not do in other circumstances. But in this circumstance, you do. This happens in war all the time. And in fact, you think about some of the battle plans. We're talking about, I just mentioned earlier about the book of Joshua. Later on in the book, actually, I think it was the Battle of Jericho. Do you remember how they... Well, let me think for a minute. No, that was marching around a bunch of times. Do you remember later on in the book of Joshua, in Judges, rather, where Gideon attacked the Midianites? Do you remember how he, you know, what his battle plans were according to God? I hope I'm getting
Wasn't that the one where he, like, broke the pots and the torches?
Yeah, that's right. So they caught a bunch of foxes and they put pots on their tail and then they lit them and then they ran around. Now I think sometimes what this was meant to do is was meant to create confusion with the enemy, because when the foxes are running around with all these lights on their tails and starting fires at night, mm-hmm. for the people in the camp, what does it look like? It looks like a huge army is swooping down on them, right?
Mm.
But did Gideon have a huge army?
Nope.
He just had a handful, like 300 men or something, right? So do you notice in the battle plan, there was deception that was built into it? Does that make sense?
Yep.
So a lot of times in battle, I mean, this is part of the way things are done there. And that was God's battle plan, as I recall, not just Gideon's. Gideon wasn't that brave or that bright, apparently. But I think maybe here's the best way to look at it, okay? As you're being let me back up a step just for a second. Do you play any sports, Josh?
What?
Do you play any sports?
No.
Okay. Well, this isn't going to be a real good illustration. Do you play any instruments?
Yeah, the piano.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so when you start learning the piano, what do you learn? Da 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 da. Right, you learn these scales and all of these boring things that are part of learning how to play. You don't get creative; you play by all the rules. But once you get better at piano and you know how to play by the rules, you know also when it's okay to you know when to, in a certain sense, to break the rules a little bit. If you broke the rules at the beginning, you'd be breaking them in all the wrong places, and you wouldn't be able to play good music. But when you get better at a thing, then you learn that there are some variations that could come into play in music. I think the same thing happens in morality. When parents teach their children, they got to teach them the foundation things, the basic rules. These are the rules you always follow, and that's the right way to start out. As we grow older, we realize that living in a fallen world causes us to face awkward circumstances in which all of the simple rules as we learned them, which are good rules, don't always apply quite the way we learned them. And this is where we then have to make some adjustments. But we can only make the adjustments properly if we know how the rules work to begin with. And that's why laying that foundation is really important.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome, Josh, and I'm still looking forward someday to going bass fishing with you out there in those beautiful Maine waters.
Yeah, we've been catching a lot of largemouth this summer.
I know. I got the picture. I think I got a picture of one of you with a nice largemouth and one of you with a really nice smallmouth. I don't remember who it was, had which, but you were you in a canoe, is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, one of these days, maybe we'll get on the water and maybe I'll show you a few tricks. What do you think?
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, Josh. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Say hi to your folks and your brother for me, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. Bye-bye. What a treat to talk to such bright young Christian people. Oh, would that God would fill our families with children like that. Fill our quiver full of those kinds of arrows, and that the next generation of Christians would be like Josh and his brother. There's a lot of them out there, by the way, and this is an encouraging thing for us to see. Let me backtrack just for a moment. I want to go back over what I said, and I don't take anything back, but I hope that those of you listening can appreciate, in a certain sense, the awkward circumstance that I was in, because you know as adults that moral decision-making is not always easy. it isn't always just a matter of simply following a set of rules. I'm not against the rules. I think that God gives us moral rules for a reason, to help us make decisions, to do the right thing. But you and I both know that life is not tidy. It's messy. And moral decision-making is messy, too. And so there are times in a fallen world we run into conflict with these rules, and then we have to figure out, now what? Well, we can't do a good job in those, dealing with those moral dilemmas, unless we had had a solid foundation to work from the beginning. And this is where I go back to Josh's piano playing. When you learn to play the piano, you play by the rules. If you want to get creative, and this is, you know, this is a thing from the 60s, let the kids express themselves. Kids don't know how to express themselves. It's chaos. It doesn't do them any good to just express themselves. What you have to do is you got to teach them to play within draw within the lines and play by the rules in everything. Once they learn how the whole thing works, whether it's music or soccer or morality, then when there may be times to go outside of the lines, as a matter of discreet and careful judgment, then you can get creative in music, then you can get creative in sports, then you can get, in a sense, I don't know if I like this word here, but creative in morality. Or you have the freedom then to deal with specialized problems by making nuanced applications and not just always following the rules. Because frankly, in moral dilemmas, the rules are the problem. In moral dilemmas, you've got two competing rules. Look at the disciples in Acts chapter 4 facing a moral dilemma. Obey the authorities over you. That's all through the New Testament. Preach the gospel. That's through the New Testament, too. What happens when the authorities say don't preach? Well, Peter had faced that situation. And they preached. And then they got whipped. And then they were told to stop preaching. And Peter says, we can't stop preaching. For there's only one name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. You have to decide, he said, whether we should obey God rather than men. You want to be our judge? You decide that. But as for us, we cannot stop speaking that which we've seen or heard. See, Peter was willing to go against the authorities, which was, in other circumstances, would have been wrong. He was breaking a rule. Because there was a greater good that was at stake. Incidentally, just as a postscript here on this discussion on moral dilemmas and what might be called graduated or graded absolutes, that we have certain moral obligations that on the face of them are absolutes or objective, certainly are objective, but they are only absolute in the sense that they are objective but then give way to a higher, more weighty absolute when there's a conflict. And so there are greater commandments and there are lesser commandments. Jesus himself said this. So that's a sound New Testament teaching. But we are only free to do that when we are faced with this kind of moral dilemma where it's either one or the other, and then we do the greater good. And when we do, and this is the little wrinkle I wanted to add as a postscript, when we do the thing that normally would have been bad, like disobeying our authorities, we're not doing a bad thing. We're doing a good thing. Now, some people want to say, and maybe this is Jay Warner's view, I don't know, some people want to say, well, we still have to do the greater good, but when we do the greater good by lying, we are still doing something wrong. And so you could actually, that's doing the lesser of two evils is the approach. In my way of looking at, you're doing a good thing, and the other way of looking at, you're doing a bad thing. In both cases, you have to choose the thing with the greatest moral weight. I don't think the right way of approaching it is that you do the lesser of two evils, because that means when you're doing the right thing, you're doing an evil thing. And that sounds confounding to me. Plus, it also would result if Jesus were ever stuck in that very same circumstance, which in principle it could have happened. then if your view is that you're still doing something wrong, even though you ought to do that, then Jesus could have sinned. And I think that's a significant problem, too. Anyway, something to think about. Got to go to break now, and I'll come back to your calls in just a few moments. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. This is Greg Kokel here with an invitation for you to join with other listeners who are making a difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the financial support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Their gifts keep Stand to Reason providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Through STR, Christians can learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and winsome. I think you'll agree that our world, our cities, our neighborhoods need effective Christian ambassadors. Well, if you want to make a difference like this, would you consider supporting STR Radio today? You can make a gift to STR by calling 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or you can donate online at str.org. You know, training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their values. And you can play your part in STR's mission by calling 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or donate online at str.org today. Thanks.
Is science the only way we can discover knowledge? It turns out that not only are there other ways, some are more immediate and accurate than science. Find out what they are in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Find it on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive Making Abortion Unthinkable prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids, simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric, clear the red herring objections, and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
Catch you here, Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel. 1-800-227-5278. And let's go to our friend Tim in Kobe, Japan. Tim, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
What time is it for you right now in Kobe?
Well, now it's 7:43, but I was just enjoying a little bit of breakfast while I was listening to the last discussion there.
Oh, this is breakfast tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. It's Monday morning.
Right. You know, if you're careful with that that international dateline, you can celebrate your birthday twice if you happen to be traveling
right.
on that day. Yeah,
Long
that's great.
And everything else, huh?
Yeah, but at my age, I don't really care to do that. But go ahead, Tim. Sorry.
Yeah, I'd say you can also miss it if you go in the wrong direction. You see, you don't get to celebrate yourself.
Does that mean I don't age a year if I kind of pop backwards that way?
Yeah, there you go. It's kind of like your daylight savings time. That's why you're all confused right now. Huh?
That's right. So what's on your mind?
We don't have to deal with changing time and all that sort of stuff. So.
Yeah. So what's on your mind today, Tim?
Well, last week you discussed theistic evolution, I generally agree with what you're saying, of course, and particularly when it comes to somebody like Ken Miller, what he was getting at by saying he's actually believes in God and stuff, and yet the characterization he made of that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's quite that it's true of all theistic evolutionists.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the for instance, I'd have to do more research to find if it was exactly if it was Francis Collins who said this or not. I'm not too sure, but I've heard theistic evolutionists characterize it as, you know, God working through in an unseen way, guiding the process. And in, you know, in theory, in principle, I can see that, that God could do that way. For instance, if you wanted to, I mean, even in theory, you could, for instance, even say a chance process, what we consider a chance process through, the, you know, the quantum level events and stuff and guiding those. So it would be totally undetectable from, by a scientist. It would look totally, you know,
I don't think you need to even go to the quantum physics kind avenue. You could just say that God is able to work in a way that's undetectable. Certainly, if it's in the ancient past where no one was there to observe it, if God is investing information, if he's adding information into a genome at certain points in time to get changes that then are going to be advantageous for that organization, for that organism rather, I mean, that, that would not be detectable by any methods nowadays, but, although it might be inferred by the evidence that we have, it, it wouldn't be directly detectable. So, but see, the, here's the problem. And Tim, just for the, for those that are listening in, and didn't catch my show last week, I want to, just bring them up to date on the point that I made last week. I made the main point I was making, if somebody wants to advance theistic evolution and they are using the broad phrase, God used evolution, what they are obliged to do, and this is whether it's Ken Miller or Francis Collins or anyone else, what they're obliged to do to keep such a statement from sounding like a magic wand, they're obliged to at least characterize in some way what it would look like for God to use evolution. And I think my question was, what exactly did God do? But when I hear from a lot of the theistic evolution crowd, and this is, includes the Biologos crowd as well, Francis Collins group, it doesn't seem like they're ever willing to specify. They just, it sounds like they accept the mechanistic characterization of it that the, all the materialists advance, and then just want to kind of add God in some nebulous way. And it's, if we are going to advance theistic evolution, then we have to, I think, with integrity, intellectual integrity, show what we think it means for God to do something. What does he do? And if he did, like you suggested, what I think is a legitimate suggestion, you know, at some point, in a way that might not be detectable, but at some point it looks like he's got to add information into the genome. Well, of course, at the, if that's what one means by it, then they're not talking about Darwinian evolution, because neo-Darwinism says that the information is added to the genome through mutations. And then natural selection works on it. And if you're saying that it's not a chance mutation, but a directed change in the genome, that's a form of intelligent design, which is odious to these folks, including Francis Collins. So this is why I raised the issue. Do you have a suggested way out of that problem?
Well, not specifically, but the point I always wanted to make was that, I mean, actually, I agree with what you said, though, but the point I wanted to make is that the reason I would reject that, what you might call, you know, gradual creationism or something like that, where it's, where God creates just by one minute step after another as he gradually changes things, you know, which would on the surface look like revolution, like Darwinian evolution, if you just look at the results. It's just that the fossil record doesn't support it. That, you know, the record of life and that we can see shows, you know, no change or state.
No, I think that's a good observation. Of course, one could posit a kind of a, and I wasn't thinking of this you know, this gradualism that you see in standard Darwinian model, and that God is making these itty bitty changes instead of mutations making. I was thinking of more something, some saltation or some big move like punctuated equilibrium of Stephen Jay Gould. I mean, this would be more like it, I think. And those who hold to to intelligent design sometime will suggest that there's got to be a big infusion of information here, some huge creative act that is not by chance, but it's actually a directed thing. So
anyway, the point I want to make was just that part should be emphasized. And when we talk about theistic evolution, just adding the God on the side without giving, like making it a magic wand. That's a really good point.
Mm-hmm.
But the other point is just that, does the evidence actually support the kind of gradualism that they are required to believe in? And I say, no, it doesn't.
Right, right. No, I'm with you on that. There are a lot of problems with the Darwinian model on its own. Finding a design model that fits all the evidence, I think that's another task altogether. And for those who say, gee, if you go with intelligent design, this is a science stopper, it seems to be nothing of the kind, because there are all kinds of questions that you can ask. Look at is it a science stopper when you find a body and you determine that this body, this dead body, was killed not by natural causes but by foul play? I mean, the process of scientific CSI investigation doesn't stop there because there's an agent involved. It just moves in a new direction. And I think people like Hugh Ross, for example, are really heavily involved in trying to come up with a scientific model that is meant to explain actually how did this happen, given that we have such profound evidence of intrusion by an intelligent agent in the whole process of the development of life and of the universe. So I don't think it's a science stopper, that's for sure.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like if you're philosophically committed to naturalism no matter what, I mean, in that case, it's like you got a body with bullet holes in it, and you figure, well, there must have been some, little lead meteorite that came down from heaven.
That's exactly right. No, you have to deny the obvious. I have an illustration called the Oreo experiment, where a chemist who's really good at figuring out precipitates and solutions and stuff like that, because he's really clever with that kind of stuff, is then challenged to figure out how did this particular precipitate, this clumpy stuff in the solution, come to be. And then when you pull the cloth off the beaker, what you see is a beaker full of water with an Oreo cookie in the bottom. And there you can see it, O-R-E-O. And he said, what, is this a joke? What, there's a cookie there. I said, no, you can't. That's an Oreo. Yeah, you can't do that. You've broken the rules. You've now appealed to agency. You've got to explain how this came about by natural processes. And you can see when you have something so obviously the result of an intelligent design, the Oreo cookie and the beaker, how foolish and ridiculous it would be to try to come up with some kind of naturalistic scenario that can account without any appeal to human agency for the cookie and the beaker, the Oreo experiment. So I think you're right. This is the way it appears much of the time, where you have powerful evidence for agency, for an intelligent designer in the natural world, and anybody in any other circumstance looking at the evidence would see this, but that conclusion is dismissed as being unscientific. You know, that's not science. So let's try to figure out a naturalistic process. Well, you're not going to get it, because it wasn't a naturalistic process that produced that.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, Tim.
Good talking
to you.
I keep listening to your podcast every week. So,
well, I'm glad. Well, glad to hear from you when we're able. You're breaking up a little bit, so I'm just going to say goodbye to you and thank you for the call. It's always good to get calls from all over the globe. It just makes us feel like we're really reaching out, which we are. And we when I was in Europe last year, this year, actually twice, once in Hungary and once in Italy, just running into people that were familiar with Santa Reason, listen to the podcast and the like. It's really great. But I don't want you to miss this particular point about intelligent design and theistic evolution. If you want to be a theistic evolutionist, you're welcome to that. But you've got to be intellectually rigorous in the process. You can't kind of give the nod to the materialistic process as if it's totally adequate to do the job. For one, it doesn't seem to be so. as our last caller was pointing out. But at the same time, you have to go further, and you got to say, well, if you're going to say that God was somehow necessary and the material process wasn't by itself adequate, that God had to do something to use the theistic the evolutionary process, then, you know, it behooves you to tell us what you think that is. And if God doesn't do anything, if all that God does is he fills a little gap in your language there, and you say, well, God does it, and you wave your hand, and you bring God, and you baptize Darwinism with theism, well, you haven't done the job. Just get rid of the theistic part and just acknowledge you're a materialistic evolutionist who has some theological wishful thinking at the same time. That's the way it seems to me. Well, there's our music, end of our first hour. Plenty of folks on the line will get to you and some things about voting when I return. Hour number two just ahead on Stan Terese. And welcome to Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host, with you every week and glad to be so, that is, with you and talking with you. Although right now our lines are completely full from our first hour, and we'll be getting your calls in just a moment. Of course, what we do here is we stand to reason for classical Christianity and classical Christian values. That's what I'm making the case for, and regardless of what it is that I'm talking about. I have a lot of calls on, and actually one's coming up about voting, and so I think it's appropriate. My opening comments are going to be about that, and now I want to make very clear to you that I'm not taking in my comments any partisan or sectarian point of view here. I want to talk about voting, as it were, in the abstract, and as I was going over my notes, I noticed just a phrase there that reminded me of something from the Constitution, and it just struck me as an appropriate time just to read the preamble of the Constitution of the United States to set a backdrop for this, because I want you to vote. I'm not going to tell you how to vote. I'm not even going to suggest or hint, but I want you to vote, and I'm going to give you in just a few moments a couple of reasons why you should vote, and a couple of reasons of what, in very general sense, you should vote for. But some of what you vote for has to do with what I'm going to read here in the preamble. And I wasn't really planning on doing that, except for I grabbed my copy of the Constitution, which I keep with me here in my radio materials, just to read the preamble quickly. And frankly, I was just, as I was doing it, just before the music came up for the start of this hour, I was taken with the sublimity of the notions that are expressed here. Now, when I was a kid, I memorized this, and I still know it pretty good. And I was glad to hear my 7-year-old daughter reciting it a couple of months ago. And so she's being taught this, but it's something that everyone should learn. It's not hard. So let me read it to you. This is the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. And it's kind of in this spirit that we have a great experiment that started over 200 years ago, nearly 250 now. We're getting there, aren't we? And it is one that has survived well because of the sentiments, I think, expressed in this document, and because the idea that citizens should have a say. Now, we're not a strict democracy. We're a representative republic, which means that we vote for people who pass the laws. In some states where they have propositions and the initiative process, there is direct democracy, I guess, and California is one of those states. I have very mixed feelings about that, by the way, and usually I think it's a bad idea. And many of you can see who have followed the initiative process, you can see how easy it is to manipulate the rank and file with rhetorical appeals on these advertisements for initiatives that seem to have nothing to do with the details of the initiatives themselves, but are meant to move people against them emotionally or for them emotionally. So that's a liability of direct democracy. We have a representative republic, and in order for that republic to work, citizens participate, or they need to participate. So I want to give you, in light of the fact that Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and within the next 72 hours, you will have an opportunity to make a difference. I want to give you some reasons why you ought to vote. And again, I'm not taking any side in this battle here on this show. Here's one reason. I think you should vote to help secure sound, wise, honorable, and noble leadership for our nation. Our nation is run by leaders, people who we elect. Do you want good leaders or bad leaders? If you want good leaders, you have an opportunity to make a difference in that regard. You can weigh in to elect what you think or who you think would be the kinds of people that would give proper leadership to our nation. Here's another reason. You can vote in order to inform the law for good and not for evil. The Bible says that governments have been ordained by God for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. So part of the role of government is to have legislation that restrains evil and encourages good. Now here's my question. Who gives content to the words good and evil in that sense? If you are not involved in the process, your vote about what is good or evil doesn't count. We live in largely a relativistic society. In a relativistic society, who is it that decides what's good? Well, the people decide what's good. And who are the people? You. So you get an opportunity to weigh in on what you think is good, whatever that happens to be. And if your conviction is that it is right for the government to do the good and to punish the evil and to encourage the good in others, well, those words good and evil need some definition, and it's your vote that helps give those words definition. I think you should also vote to participate in community decision making. You're a member of a community. You have a say in what goes on here. We're not slaves in this country. We're not serfs who don't get to have a say so. We are people who are citizens who get to participate. We each get a voice through our vote, and you can express your voice in your vote in the area of community decision making. And one final reason I think you should vote is because you're going to have to live with the outcome. And if for whatever reason you don't like the way things are going, if you don't take the opportunity that you've been given to make a difference in the way things are going, then you have no right to complain, seems to me. So those are four good reasons to vote: to secure good leadership, according to your understanding of what that good leadership looks like, to inform the law for good, not evil, to participate in community decision-making, and because you have to live with the outcome. Now, What are the kinds of things that ought to guide your vote? And again, I'm going to give something very broad and general, not sectarian or partisan in any sense. I've already hinted to the first thing, you should vote for what is good and right. Now, people are going to differ on what this entails. But that should be the substance of your vote. And what's, well, what else you might be thinking? And I'll tell you what else. The alternative for voting for what's good and right is for voting for something that will benefit you personally. Now, a lot of people vote for their personal benefit. I understand that. Some politician is promising them something. And this happens on both sides of the aisle, no question about that. But I'm asking you to think beyond your personal desires, needs, or benefits that might accrue to you, and ask, what is good for the nation? What is good for my community? And it may be that there are choices you could make that would benefit you individually that might not be good for everybody. You live in a community. And so I'm suggesting that you vote for what is good and right in the broad sense. A second thing I'd like to encourage you to do is not to vote to make a statement, but to vote to make the greatest difference for good. Now, I raise this because sometimes people feel they cannot vote for someone that doesn't hold all of their particular and peculiar views, and therefore they then pitch their vote for someone that is much closer to their view but may be unelectable. Well, when you do this, you make a statement. You are saying, I'm siding with this noble, from your perspective, cause. But keep in mind, if you do that, you're not going to make a difference if your particular candidate is not in play. And we've talked about this a lot in the past, about different moral issues here. And my suggestion is, be wise the way you vote. Try to use your vote to make the greatest difference for the good that you have in mind, rather than just making a statement. Let's face it, there's no politician that's going to be just right unless you're writing in your own name. Then you can guarantee to be voting for somebody who thinks just like you. Other than that, you're going to have to, take the best that you can get at the moment under the circumstances, and that's all I'm suggesting. The third thing that I want to mention, and this is for those of you in states that do have initiative process, and propositions that direct democracy that I referred to earlier, is that you vote on a proposition not simply based on the intent of the proposition. All laws and propositions that are up for voting on now are candidates for law. All laws have a certain intent, and then they have a certain content. And some things may have a certain good intent, but in the content end up doing a whole lot of other things that are not as good as the noble thing they're trying to accomplish. And this is why sometimes politicians will vote against a bill that's come up in Congress, for example, or in the Senate, not because they're against the sentiments of the bill, but they think the bill is poorly written, or there will be an unseen consequence to this well-intended bill down the line or in a broad way here that nobody's really thinking about. And if you just simply say, I like the idea of that proposition, that doesn't tell you whether the proposition as it's worded will accomplish what it's trying to accomplish and won't accomplish certain bad things that it is meant to avoid. So the words matter. The content matters. So my encouragement here is to vote not based on the intent of the proposition, but take some time to read the proposition. You're not going to get the content of these things by watching ads, I promise you. You want to know what the actual provisions are of the bill and the impact it will have both in the short term and in the long term. And by the way, if you can't figure that out, if you're not sure about that, you don't mark either box. Just don't vote for it. if your vote is not an intelligent vote, don't vote. It's better that you make no impact than have a bad impact. All right. Now, that seems to me common sense. In any event, so what I've offered here, again, in a very general sense, is that when you vote, you're voting for what is good and right, the common good as you understand it, what you think will advance the common good, instead of your just your personal little things. That's narrow, that's selfish, that's not good for the community. Vote not to make a statement, but to make the greatest difference. And finally, vote when you have a proposition, not on the sentiment or the intent of the proposition, but actually on the content of the bill, what will actually take place if it gets passed. Now, since I felt so strongly about encouraging people to vote, I actually posted something carefully worded on my Facebook that I just want to read to you. Part of the reason is because I want you to see me taking care within the limitations I have as a 501c3 to still encourage people to fulfill their civic duty, because I think it's such an important thing. So that if you see that, you might be inspired to maybe send out some emails yourself and encourage others to participate in the process to make a difference for the good as they see it. And what I posted on my Facebook amounts to this. I wrote, in just a few days, you'll have an unprecedented opportunity to make a difference for good in this country. And I'm sending this note in a nonpartisan way as a fellow citizen to personally encourage you to vote on Tuesday. It's hard for me to put into words how important the election is, this particular one, and how much hangs in the balance for America. And if you think of any area that concerns you deeply, and frankly, I'm not going to go into all of those details, because I don't want anybody to construe this as a partisan effort even now. But there's a whole host of them, and you can make the list yourself. They're all issues, and I've got probably a dozen of them on here that right off the top of my head that are in play in this election. They're all issues that will be deeply influenced by the outcome on Tuesday. And this a question on this is coming up. If you're in a state whose electoral votes already appear to be decided, there's a lot more to vote on than just that. I'll be talking about that more in a minute with a caller. But the popular vote counts too. So your voice still matters regardless. And then I closed it by saying that these are serious times, which I think they are. Don't miss this opportunity, because you may never have one quite like this again. And that's my encouragement to you, to all that are listening. Don't miss this opportunity. And again, I want to reiterate, as I did in the postscript to the piece on my Facebook, do not post anything even remotely partisan by way of response to my appeal. I said that about the Facebook, but I want to reiterate that I've carefully worded everything I've said here to avoid posturing on either side in this election. I think the issues that I'm speaking to and the values that I'm mentioning, that is the values of being good citizens and voting, are of equal concern to those on either side of the aisle. And this is an encouragement to exercise your right, your privilege, and your civic responsibility to vote, and not anything else. So don't make anything more out of it. But that ought to be enough, all right? A word to the wise is sufficient. Well, your call's coming up in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
Temptation in human history, one that targets the authority of God's word at its very foundation. Its modern rephrasing takes many forms, both in academia and in popular culture. Are the New Testament documents reliable? Have ancient biblical books been lost or suppressed by the early church? Are the words of the Bible just flawed human inventions? These questions introduce doubt at the point of contact between God and man, undermining the Christian's confidence in the words of Scripture. Even those secure in their affirmation of divine authorship must wrestle with similar questions. Did God really say to me? In other words, do the promises of Scripture apply to the individual Christian's life today, or only to those originally addressed? How is one to understand and apply these biblical assurances? in this timely collection of essays called Ancient Words, Reflections on the Reliability and Proper Use of Scripture, Greg carefully addresses each of these issues, providing both solid evidence for the reliability of Scripture and a clear roadmap for how it should be read and applied. Greg's responses to these popular challenges to biblical authority will help reinforce your confidence in this trustworthy book. Go to Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org and get a copy of Ancient Words, or call 1-800-2-REASON.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. When we read the Gospels or one of Paul's letters, can we be confident that 2,000 years later we have what they originally wrote? The answer is a clear yes, and all we have to do is point to the facts. Find out what those facts are in my Bulletproof podcast this month. Look for Bulletproof on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Speaking events, new resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Post comments and interact with STR staff and other like-minded Christians. You can find all our social media connections at str.org.
Go back with you here on Stand to Reason. Reminds me of college. All right, let's go to our callers. And in light of the opening commentary, Mike, your call from Montana is appropriate. What's on your mind, Mike?
Yeah, it's perfect timing. I guess, you know, are there any tactics that you know of how you would respond to someone who would say, you know, look, I don't live in one of the few swing states, so no matter how I vote, all my electoral votes in my state are going to go to a certain candidate, right, no matter what. So what's the point? I mean, whether I vote or whether I don't.
Let me answer it quickly. The last time I looked at the ballots, there were a whole lot more on that ballot than just the executive office. And electoral votes govern the election of the executive, but not anyone or anything else. And on most ballots, not on most, all ballots, they have a lot of other offices that are in play. Senate races, governorships, House of Representatives on the U.S. level, then on the state level, you've got all kinds of offices. And not only do you have that, but there are initiatives, local and statewide, that are things that are important for, I think, any citizen to weigh in on. So if one's attitude is, I don't need to vote because in my state the decision has been made, or so they think, then they're treating their ballot as if there are only two names on the ballot, and that is the competing presidential candidates. But that just isn't the case. And so all of the things that I said about the need and importance to vote, that is, participating in the community decision-making process and helping to secure honorable, noble, wise leadership, informing the law for good, not evil, and the fact that you have to live with the outcome applies to all of the other things on the ballot, not just with the executive branch. And indeed, one could argue that it's even more important because on the statewide and local elections, one's individual vote has greater weight because it's drawing from a smaller pool the more and more local you get. So instead of being one in 180 million, you're one in maybe 10,000 or 5,000 or 1,000 in your community. And that certainly increases the impact of your vote.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Well, let's say, you know, someone who holds this position is, you know, likely to be someone who also doesn't follow, you know, local politics. So if there's someone who, you know, it doesn't follow local politics, elections coming up, you know, they do know a little bit about the president, they know who they would vote for, but, you know, they just say, what's the point of voting? So just limiting it to the presidential
Okay,
race.
Well, if I were to limit it to that, then there would be only one rationale that I could offer. And the rationale is that the popular vote count matters. Clearly, it's not decisive. When you're living in a representative republic that uses the Electoral College, it's the electoral votes that elect. But sometimes we've had majority presidents, and sometimes, occasionally, rarely, we've had minority presidents. Sometimes, just because of idiosyncrasies, you can have a close race in the Electoral College, and you could have a wide gap in popular voting. And what the popular vote does is it's helpful to see whether the people are giving the elected candidate a mandate or not. If you have a wide differential in the popular vote, regardless of how close the Electoral College is, because that's kind of artificial in a certain way anyway, meaning you could have a close vote in that, but a wide disparity in the popular vote. If you have a wide disparity in the popular vote, then this tends to communicate to the one elected that that the people by and large are behind their agenda. And it gives them a firmer ground to stand on. And if it's very, very close, then it, even if there's an electoral landslide, it does communicate to the parties that America is deeply divided and that whoever ends up winning has got to rule a little bit more gingerly and reach across the aisle more if they want to get something done, because the people are not clearly and fully on the side of the one who won. All this could be determined in the popular vote. It's unrelated to the Electoral College. And so in that sense, I think the vote still really matters.
Yeah. And I agree with you. Again, I'm not trying to give you a hard time, but this person that I have in mind, I'm pretty sure what he would come back and say. And he's not just, you know, trying to give me a hard time. He really, this is the way he thinks.
Mm-hmm.
He would say, well, you know, again, I'm only one vote, so, you know, what would I care if somebody loses by 1 million or if they lose by 1 million mm-hmm. and one?
Yeah, well, I understand the point of view, and if everybody else thought that way, then most people's voice would not have an impact. A vote counts. Even if it's one part of 100 million, it's still your voice. And remember, every one of these candidates, whoever gets elected, is elected by a bunch of individual people. All of those individual votes add up. Now, if this guy is so lackadaisical about this that they just figure, what the heck, it doesn't matter, well, then he doesn't have to participate. He can't play. He can't complain about the outcome. You know, he's not a member, an active member of the community. And that's the way, you know, I'm not going to tell you a fancy tactic that's going to get him to brighten up and take all of this seriously if he just doesn't care.
Yeah.
But I, one of the reasons that I read from the Constitution, the preamble, that noble paragraph, is it's ennobling to me to read it. As I read through it, I think I want a more perfect union, justice. I want to do something to ensure the domestic tranquility, for goodness sake, and provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty, not just to myself, but I got posterity too, Eva and Annabeth. They're right there in that opening part of the Constitution. So this is me that is being represented here, and so I want to have my voice counted. And if your friend doesn't want to have his voice counted, then all right, let him go. Let the dead bury the dead, you know.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that.
All right, Mike. I appreciate your call from Montana. And let's see, where are we at here time-wise? Okay, we can go to more and Chicago and Phil. Hello, Phil.
Hi, Greg. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, nice to talk to you.
I don't know if you remember a brief history. I called you a couple months back asking about how to get apologetics class or course started at our church, and just wanted to let you know that my friend and I did successfully start a class, and
great.
We've been going through the True You project going through the Does God Exist series.
Isn't that a fabulous series?
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah,
it's just great. I agree. There's another one that – this is the one that the Truth Project crowd put out, and it's really accessible. It's great for a group. It's Stephen Meyer is the main guy doing the teaching in a kind of a smallish, old-fashioned classroom. It looks like – reminded me of the 50s, you know, when I was when I was a kid. But it's just a great presentation. He's also done another one on the Bible, so there's a second – set of a series, a second class, if you want to, you know, continue on after this one, that's available. So I'm glad you're using that. I'm glad you're rolling on this one.
Yeah. Actually, that probably will actually be our next section that we get into. I do want to let you know too that I was working with my friend Jason, who's also on the line with me. I talked to the enforcer while I was on hold, and she said it was okay to add him in conference.
Oh, okay. Jason, huh? Are you there, Jason?
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. I think this is the first time we've ever had two callers on at the same time. So.
Yeah, I'm sorry for the surprise. I didn't mean to get you off guard like this.
No, that's quite all right. I can handle it. I'll rise to the occasion here.
Yeah. The course has been going really well, and we just finished the section talking mainly about DNA, and everything is going great, and we got towards the end of the class, and I had one student come up and basically ask me directly, kind of as people were leaving and so on, because I had made a statement that I thought evolution was lame. And I think I meant that really in the context of both in a scientific sense of falling short of explanation and also from a theological standpoint. But at the end of the class, he had asked me, are my feelings that evolution is lame because of primarily theological concerns or scientific concerns? And he's a self-stated Christian that, falls along the line of someone who is theistic evolution and was wanting to probe me, I guess, to try to understand where my hang-up was about not accepting evolution into our belief system or our worldview. I answered that primarily for me, I don't have as much biological or scientific background in evolution, but that I thought my concerns were primarily theological. And Jason was there to go through the conversation with me and kind of walk through some of the tactics, and we asked him some questions and even brought up the boiling water and leprechaun scenario. So everything seemed to be going well in our conversation, other than I guess we all kind of left the conversation. He had not really shown signs of budging in his position.
So he holds to the Darwinian model, but he is a Christian. Is that right? So would he he'd identify himself as a theistic evolutionist?
Right.
Okay.
And this is Jason. If I can kind of add in there, because we're kind of going back and forth a little bit, and I was kind of hitting him with some of the Columbo questions of really asking some theological questions, asking for what kind of theological implications that has on his faith. And I was asking some of the, about the Adam and Eve question. What does he do with that?
Excellent.
And I think what our main question is kind of I kind of hold that evolution and Christianity aren't compatible. And at least in if you push it as far, to its logical conclusion, I guess so our question is, can someone get to that point where maybe they can lose their salvation being a theistic evolutionist?
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody's salvation is disqualified simply in virtue of that belief. I don't think that's a heresy. That is, if you believe in theistic evolution, then you are somehow outside of the pale. I think the idea is heterodox. And that is, it's not orthodox it's not sound, but it's not on the level of heresy. That's my view. You know, some people might be listening saying, oh my gosh, I can't believe he's saying that. But I use the word heresy in a very restricted sense. To me, it's a term of art. It refers to something very particular. It means a false view that disqualifies somebody from being accepted or considered within the broad pale of Christianity. There could be all kinds of heterodox views that people have, and in fact they do, but they still are within what might be called mere Christianity. But if you say you reject, for example, the deity of Christ, or the two natures of Christ, or the Trinity, or the blood atonement, or something like, well, these are clearly outside of Christianity. So I don't consider theistic evolution to be like that. I think that one of the key things in this discussion, this goes back to our first Colombo question, is what do you mean by that? When a person is talking about evolution and they believe in evolution, they really need to dial down exactly what they're referring to. And the Darwinian model, which is the neo-Darwinian model, is mutation plus natural selection equals motion forward in the biological realm for evolution. And mutation and natural selection is the operational model now that most materialistic scientists believe is responsible for the biological variety in this world. Notice, by the way, that both of those, mutation and natural selection, are unguided things. Neither of them are the result of a mind causing a particular change. The mutation is accidental, nor selecting for it. It's the environment that selects. So these are mindless pieces of the system. But if those are the two pieces of the system, and both are mindless by definition, that is, they're undirected, then I don't know how you can attach the word theistic to that in a meaningful way. And again, it brings me back to the question of, does God, if the theistic part of theistic evolution is meaningful, in order for it to be meaningful, you've got to say what you think God actually did. And the minute you start specifying that, it's going to sound too much like intelligent design for any card-carrying evolutionist in the Darwinian sense, macroevolution, or neo-Darwinian sense. It's going to be too much like intelligent design for any of those evolutionists to want to acknowledge that this is a legitimate option. And it just seems like you can't have it both ways. And this is what a lot of the theistic evolutionists want to do. They want to stay general. They want to say, yeah, I believe in, you know, the Darwin thing. Yeah, because that's respectable. And this is what, but I believe God used it. And then they don't say anything more than that. But that sounds like a just-so story to me. That's not enough detail to help anybody. It certainly doesn't sound very scientific because it doesn't give any detail. So my request of a theistic evolutionist person is for them to make sense to me out of what they mean by the terms. It's not my view, it's their view. Therefore, they should know what they mean by them. Help me to understand it. And it's not enough to say, well, God used it, unless you give some detail. Because it doesn't seem like Darwinism, at least the way I understand it, they seem to be affirming it, is something God can use. There's a writing that I did, and I'm actually going to revisit this in a couple of months, but I talked about how is it that you get... how do you deal out a royal flush in poker, fellas? Well, you take your chances, shuffle the deck and deal it, and that's chance. Take your chances, and you get lucky, or you can stack the deck and make it happen. That's called cheating. There's no other options. Mm-hmm. You can't design by chance a royal flush in poker. There is no middle alternative there. But I think this is exactly what theistic evolutionists seem to be trying to do, or seem to think that it's possible, but they stay general enough not to have to rise to the task. Well, God used it, and that's all they end up saying. I think this becomes much more evident, Chris and Phil, when you talked, and I think it was Phil that you mentioned this, when you talk about Adam and Eve. Well, where do they come into it? And this is where the BioLogos crowd is really faltering, because for a while there, they were bringing a lot of people on board, theologians, based on the idea that the Darwinian model has got this thing nailed. It's covered, man. And so we've got to make some adjustments here and become theistic evolutionists. And then they start asking very specific questions about Adam and Eve. And pretty soon you realize what ends up happening with the theistic evolutionist point of view is there's very little theistic and there's a whole lot of evolution in there. Because you don't end up with a historical Adam and Eve. But if you don't end up with an historical Adam and Eve, nothing in the Bible makes sense.
Yeah, and that is exactly, I think, where it went, is that, you know, once Adam and Eve was brought up, immediately we started to get into a conversation about how the book of Genesis was more than likely more metaphor than historical in nature, and that it was trying to teach a larger picture and not be specific about an actual Adam or an actual
Eve. Right, right. That's a literary perspective people are taking on it, but here's the question. What is it teaching? What is it teaching? What is the story meant to teach? Is the story meant to teach about the struggle? I don't need a story for that. That's my story every day.
Yeah.
Right? It's all our story. Here's what the story is meant to teach. All the story is in what book of the Bible? What book of the Bible has the story of the fall and all of that, Adam and Eve?
Genesis.
Yeah. Okay, Genesis means beginnings. It's meant to tell us how things began. How did the world begin? Who's responsible for the beginning of the world? What is ultimate reality like? What happened? What went wrong? Mm-hmm. And see, and I'm going to offer an illustration here, then I got to run to break. And that I've used many times before, and I really got this from Francis Schaeffer, because his point was, if, as I mentioned a few moments ago, if Genesis doesn't give us his history about what happened to the human race, then it doesn't explain anything. My illustration is a little boy sees a scar on his father's face, and he says, son, he says, Papa, how did you get that scar on your face? He said, well, I'll tell you, son, sit down. Once upon a time... And he said, wait, Papa, I don't want to hear a fairy tale. I don't want to hear a little story. I want to know how you got that scar. What caused that thing on your face? And there's a sense in which the human race has a scar, and the scar is fallenness. And the question is, how did we actually get the scar? Don't tell me a metaphor about scars. Tell me how the injury actually took place. And Schaeffer points out, if there is no historical fall, then the way human beings are is the way they've always been. The historical fall tells us that human beings weren't always broken. And if they weren't always broken, the brokenness is accidental and therefore in principle can be fixed. So there's hope for returning to what we started out to be like, which is what the Bible holds out for, the hope of the transformation of the resurrection. It also tells us what the problem is, that there's a moral brokenness that we brought, and that moral brokenness has ramifications. And so there's a specific problem in history that needs to be solved in history. That's how Genesis, which is the beginnings of the story, that is the account, and the beginnings of the problem, helps us then to explain how the solution plays out in the rest of the Bible. If it doesn't explain what happened in history, it doesn't do us any good, is the point. And I think that when Jesus talks about Adam and Eve in Genesis, he doesn't seem to be referring to a story about the great themes of good versus evil. He seems to be talking about an injury that man inflicted upon himself, and that God has chosen to rescue him from, and that's why Jesus came.
Excellent.
So thank you, Phil and Chris. This is the first time
Jason.
For me.
Both Jason.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking up at the wrong thing. I'm looking up at the Phil and Chris, the next two callers. I mean Jason and Phil, who I have right here written down in front of me. My bad. Okay.
That's okay.
For the correction. Jason and Phil, it's a pleasure talking with you today.
Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. And we'll do it again sometime. Oh, it's great talking to those guys in Chicago. Done it before, and I'm sure we look forward to more. We've got a break coming up. We're late on it. Let's jump to it, and I'll be back with more on Stand to Reason.
This is Greg Kokel here with an invitation for you to join with other listeners who are making a difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the financial support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Their gifts keep Stand to Reason providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Through STR, Christians can learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and winsome. I think you'll agree that our world, our cities, our neighborhoods need effective Christian ambassadors. Well, if you want to make a difference like this, would you consider supporting STR Radio today? You can make a gift to STR by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or you can donate online at str.org. You know, training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their values. And you can play your part in STR's mission by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate online at str.org today. Thanks.
Is science the only way we can discover knowledge? It turns out that not only are there other ways, some are more immediate and accurate than science. Find out what they are in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud, with Alan Schliemann. Find it on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids, simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric, clear the red herring objections, and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
Take a step, you and I have been asleep for hours. I never heard of these people before, but that's okay. I've never heard of anybody in the last 40 years. So, Greg Kokel back with you here. Stand to Reason, final segment of this hour. And let's go to West L.A. And we'll talk with Chris. Hi, Chris. Greg Kokel. Glad you called.
Hi, sir. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call, and also thank you for the outstanding work that your program does in boldly broadcasting God's standpoint.
Thank you.
I did call to respectfully take issue with some of the things that were said regarding the Halloween segment. And my question would be, or the issue for me would be, whether you believe that Christians should abstain from any activity like Halloween, for instance, that could have even the appearance of something which might not glorify God and His kingdom?
That's a very good question, and I want to be careful how I answer, because I do think that there are things that may not be wrong in themselves, but they look like they're really bad to other people, and so it looks like we're participating in evil. Say, for example, we entertain someone in a hotel room, you know, and there's no shenanigans, but they're in early and they go out late, and it's a member of the opposite sex, and it's visible to a lot of people, and that's just not smart. On the other hand, it seems to me that there are all host of other much less, much more menial or less significant kinds of things that it's possible someone, anyone could read something into if they were of a mind to. I mean, you might be in a restaurant that serves alcohol, and I guess somebody might think that you're a drunk because you're in a restaurant that serves alcohol. But that strikes me as totally on the extreme. And so just because there is the possibility that somebody might construe this maybe against the odds in some that there's something untoward going on, that in itself is not enough to dissuade me from participating in that, partly because that would mean I couldn't hardly do anything. And in fact, even if I did nothing, somebody might read into that some ungodly, inappropriate kind of motive. So I guess I'm going to take the question seriously and then make application to the kinds of things and avoid the kinds of things to see that seem to me the most obviously egregious examples or the ones that it would be reasonable to think that someone could draw a conclusion about a thing that is clearly makes me look like I've participated in something that's really wrong and ungodly. So it may sound like a kind of a wishy-washy answer, but I think there is a line there somewhere, and it might be different for different people. Well, it is different for different people. With regards to Halloween, I don't draw the line. Let's see. I think Halloween's inside of the line of tolerance on that, from my perspective. Do you think differently?
I do, and I think it resonated for me personally. I come from a traditionally Christian family, mm-hmm. raised in a Christian home, thank God. Mm-hmm. And there was a point at which we were allowed to trick or treat, and then the lines were redrawn after, my parents decided that, this is quite possibly something that really doesn't glorify the Lord. And I think it really hit home when in the workplace, for instance, we were having, or the office was having a Halloween party, and it was kind of common news that I went to church and mm-hmm. I was part of a Christian fraternity, et cetera, mm-hmm. that I was a Christian. And someone called me out and said, how is it that, and I wasn't actually participating, mm-hmm. but how is it that Christians can participate, and I know some who do, is what the person was saying, in an activity involving ghosts, goblins, and anything other than, what's usually associated with the Almighty. How can they do that and still call themselves Christian? Is it a compromise? And if so, where do you guys draw the line? Are you making accommodations because it's something you were used to doing?
Sure.
For a period of time, and so...
Yeah, well, that's a fair thing, but this is where I think more questions could be asked of this person. My question would be of this person, exactly how is that a compromise of Christian views? Now, if a person is... And even if a person is engaged in participating in the occultic themes in Halloween, which I wouldn't do, and our girls don't do, my one daughter went as a prairie girl, and the other one was dressed up as a skater. They had to tell me because I couldn't tell even by looking at them. What are you guys? Oh, I'm this. Okay, yeah, great. So we avoid that kind of stuff. We just make a costume. If somebody were to say, isn't that a compromise? I would want to know, how is that a compromise? And even if I don't know, goblins. What's a goblin? This is ghoulish, but I don't know why that's goblins aren't satanic or anything like that. I wouldn't consider it. I want to know, why would that be considered a compromise? And now you might say, well, how does that glorify God? I said, it's the same way anything else I do glorifies God. That is, if I'm living my life with integrity, even when I'm going to Walmart, you might say, well, how does Walmart glorify God? You shouldn't be going there. That's not glorifying God. Well, it's not glorifying God. And there are all kinds of things that I do that are kind of, in a certain sense, morally neutral, but I do them as a Christian man of integrity, not compromising, it seems to me. So I think that the... I think that the operational question is, does the activity dishonor God? And if it's not dishonoring God, then it qualifies in the category of honoring God. I don't know how participation in Halloween, especially when I, from what I found out, Halloween actually doesn't have pagan origins, but Christian origins. How is that dishonoring God? And that's the question that I'd want to hear an answer from the person who called you out.
Right. And if I could be real quick, I don't want to.
Sure. We got 2 minutes, a little less than, because then the music comes up and we're out of the segment. But go ahead.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yes, I do understand the point about Halloween having origins in Christianity or Christian origins. But then so did the church when the Lord established it. It was right at the beginning, and then it morphed into something which led to the Reformation. And we had to either identify with the traditions of the church as they progressed away from the Lord, or we had to cut our association with it.
Good.
And now we're
Let
we're
me jump
Protestant.
In quickly. Yes, so right. But notice how you said traditions that moved away from the Lord. These were specific things that were done that were contrary to biblical truth, and they were morally and theologically weighty. Now, that strikes me as very different from kids going door to door saying trick or treat and getting candy in a bag. Or having pumpkins sit out on your stoop or whatever. I mean, I'm not going to take exception with anyone, even yourself. If you feel it violates your own conscience, it's clear, then don't do it. But as a broader moral question, I don't see how that in itself is somehow compromising God, or is dishonoring to God.
Okay. Thank you so much for your candor.
Chris, and thank you for your question as well. And look, these are those things that I think are things people have to work out individually, and I'm not going to beat anybody up for differing with me on this. And as I mentioned earlier, my wife and I have a little bit different sensitivities, but we work around that. That's okay. And that's the way it is. The important thing is to have a principled view on it, and to be thoughtful about it. And not just fall into these things without reflection. Okay, 1 hour to go here on Stand to Reason. A little bit of room in the lines if you'd like to participate. 1-800-227-5278. I'm Greg Kokel, and you are listening to Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Nonsense.
The show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. No, not nonsense. And I'm Greg Kokel, your host. Our final hour here, actually, it's abbreviated hour in Southern California. The rest of our stations will be going for the full hour, but we'll be signing off early here at the KBRT station. And because of that, I'm just going to jump right in to it. We got lots of callers on board, and I want to go, and I'm actually quite interested in our first call. I'm interested in them all, but it caught my attention. So let's talk with Dusty here in Tucson, Arizona. Dusty, hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks.
Can I ask you a quick question before the actual question?
Uh-huh.
When are you going to write a book, maybe an ambassador's guide on classical Christianity? I mean, you're always giving your views about classical Christianity, and I think I could get a holistic view if I put everything together. But, man, I love your ambassador guide.
Well, thanks. Well, we're working on some more, but that one's not in view, partly because one could argue it's already been done. It's called Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis.
Is it wrong that I've read that 3 times and I still can't get it?
Well, it's not wrong. you know. But look, Lewis, some people get, or he resonates better with some people than others. So you kind of find your author in a way. But there are other books out there that have simple things. I am actually in the process of putting together a book called Credo, C-R-E-D-O, which means I believe. And the subtitle is The Story of Reality. And so there's a sense in which I am going to deal with the Christian narrative. Here's the story of Christianity starting from the beginning and going to the end. So the beginning will be God and the creation, and the end is the final resurrection and move into the new heavens and the new earth. And it's not a complicated book, but it's meant to chart the backbone of the Christian narrative based on five words, which are sequential and temporally sequential: God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. So something like a mere Christianity from my perspective, and maybe more accessible for your purposes, will be coming up, God willing, before too long.
Indeed. Well, anyway, getting to the main question, I was reading your Ambassador's Guide to the New Atheist regarding religion kills,
yeah.
And I've heard your actual, the MP3,
uh-huh.
And you have a couple of other materials that are just like this, but I found this was, you know, myself reading, and something came to mind. I was talking to a Christian who stated that, yes, she knew more murders have been caused by atheistic ideologies. I actually found a Guinness Book of World Records. I had to go back to 1980 and order it off of Amazon because
right.
ones don't have...
Right, they don't carry that anymore. You're right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so... you know, she said, yes, I knew more murders have been caused by atheistic ideologies than in the name of God. However, the percentage of the world population killed in the name of God was greater, i.e., you know, smaller population during the Crusades, for example. And I told her we were talking about the number of people, not the percent of the,
that's
the
right.
percentage of the world population. But after reading your book, I thought of something. And it's not, and you know, tell me if I got this from you, because, I mean, could have been. I've listened to a lot of your materials on the problem with evil, et cetera. And so it could have come up. The value of human life doesn't rise and fall according to the world population, right?
Exactly. Really good point. Let's just say early on, Adam and Eve, Cain, Abel, their kids and all that, early on, the very beginnings, then Cain kills Abel. So, wow, for religious reasons, right? So, like, that's 10% of the world population at that time. I mean, arguably.
Right.
And then a couple years later, you know, a million people are killed, but the population is a billion, you know, generations later. So Cain counts more than the million over and against the backdrop of the smaller number. I mean, that to me is a silly way of assessing it.
I thought was silly was she was a Christian saying this. I'm thinking, why would you say that in front of these other atheists?
Sure. A couple of things come to mind. First of all, I don't know that that's true. I do not know that the Crusades killed a larger proportion based on the world population. Yes, the world population was smaller. I don't know how many people the Crusades killed. All right, so that's one thing. And by the way, people always put the Crusades on the Christians. The first Crusades, at least, were a result, was a coming to arms of Christians to go to the Holy Land because Christian pilgrims were being butchered by Muslims. So it was a defensive act to rescue Christians being butchered by Muslims. It wasn't an offensive act of unjust bloodshed on behalf of Christians. Nevertheless, Christians put these all in one group. I have a book on the Crusades, by the way, a very, very good book. And I purchased it last year or the year before, and I've just skimmed it. But I'm going to try to take another look at that and see if he's got some numbers there. So I don't even – I'm not going to give her facts, first of all, unless I have good reason that she is on the money with the facts. But even if she's on the money with the facts, it's not relevant, because the question isn't whether religious violence at some point in the history of the world killed a larger proportion of the people that were existing at that time than some other kind of violence at that time.
Right.
That's not the claim. My comments were in response to the charge, which is a broad generalization, that religion has caused more wars and bloodshed than any other thing in the world. And this is simply false. Notice the claim is not made about a specific slice of time. It's just a generalized claim. You add up the bodies, you add up, just bodies across the board, and it is religion that's responsible for more of them than anything else. And that's just simply not the case. Now, has it been the case that more were killed in modern times? Yeah, that's right. Secular ideologies overwhelmed any religious bloodshed prior to it, because in the 20th century you have a lot more people and you have technology that allows us to kill more. But nevertheless, the numbers are the numbers. And it is secular ideologies that are responsible for greater bloodshed than anything else in the world. And by the way, that could have even been true before the 20th century. I just know that the 20th century knocked the lid off of it. There's no comparison with anything else. So since the question is not related to what segment of history, but it is a response to a broad challenge about what kills people, my point still stands, that it is not religion that is the responsible for this, but rather secular ideologies. And by the way, I know that some of the new atheists have made a big deal about this, but I wanted to know whether people like Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or the rest lock their door at night. And if they do, is it because there's a whole lot of really religious people that live around them that make them extra special careful? No, I think it's obvious that it is not the really religious people that we're so concerned with. It's with those people who don't think they have to make an account to anyone. That's the real issue. And keep in mind, too, that in my presentation on the new atheists and this broader problem of evil that has to do with religious violence, I made a number of points, and that was only one of them.
Right.
And that simply being that on a factual basis, they were not accurate. But the other point that I was making is, even in the case of Christianity, at least, when Christians do evil in the name of the religion, then they are not living in a way that's consistent with the teachings of the religion's founder, who himself said, "Depart from me, you who work iniquity, I never knew you." So even if Christians are doing that as a religious enterprise, then it is not intellectually credible to lay that at the feet of Jesus. You can't hold a religion responsible for the crimes of its heretics, as one person put it. All right?
Well, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, Dusty. I appreciate the call. It's a good one, and I'm glad I was able to make that clarification. Paris, California, and Delwyn. Delwyn, I used to fish in your lake.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't even go there.
Well, it's now kind of a puddle, isn't it? They drained a lot of water out of it. It used to be a world-class... Pardon me?
That and the rattlesnakes.
Oh, well, I fish on the lake, so I'm not so worried about the rattlesnakes, but I didn't realize there are a lot of them around there. Maybe I'll go back to look for rattlesnakes next time, but that used to be a world-class spotted bass fishery. In fact, there were a multitude of world records that came out of that lake before it went into decline. But in any event, that isn't what you called about.
Of course, that would change the nature of the show, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
Well, what I called about, and then we can talk about bass fishing.
Yeah.
I was doing some studying for a class.
Uh-huh.
And I got to reading Romans 13 and, you know, being in subjection to the governing authorities. And I began to wonder, based on that, would the Revolutionary War, why would it not have been a violation?
Mm-hmm.
And what really got me thinking about is when I started reading documents from the British side,
mm-hmm,
and the political activity that was going on, it paints a rather different picture from what, you know, I had been taught in elementary school, middle school, and high school.
Yeah. Well, so, you're not the first one to ask this question, and even I think Norm Geisler, for example, Christian apologist, does believe, or at least did believe, and I don't want to misquote him, I think that he held the view, though I know some do, that the revolution was not morally justified in light of Romans 13. This raises a broader question, though, and because I believe in Romans 13, the question has to do with the nature of an absolute. Let's just use that word for a moment. I don't particularly like the word, frankly, but hold on just a second, Delwyn. Are we close to a break here? Are we coming up in 3 minutes? I just wonder if I could do this in 3 minutes. Okay, we'll give it a... Hey, how about if we break early and I'll come back to Delwyn, because I don't want to give him the short shrift or crowd these commercials. Can you hold on just a minute, Delwyn, and we'll come back to this?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, that's cool.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to just push the hold button. Hopefully I'll get the right one. There we go. You're on hold. And we'll take a break and we'll come back in a few moments and we'll wind this up. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
Did God really say... It's the oldest temptation in human history, one that targets the authority of God's Word at its very foundation. Its modern rephrasing takes many forms, both in academia and in popular culture. Are the New Testament documents reliable? Have ancient biblical books been lost or suppressed by the early church? Are the words of the Bible just flawed human inventions? These questions introduce doubt at the point of contact between God and man, undermining the Christian's confidence in the words of Scripture. Even those secure in their affirmation of divine authorship must wrestle with similar questions. Did God really say to me? In other words, do the promises of Scripture apply to the individual Christian's life today or only to those originally addressed? How is one to understand and apply these biblical assurances? In this timely collection of essays called Ancient Words, Reflections on the Reliability and Proper Use of Scripture, Greg carefully addresses each of these issues, providing both solid evidence for the reliability of Scripture and a clear roadmap for how it should be read and applied. Greg's responses to these popular challenges to biblical authority will help reinforce your confidence in this trustworthy book. Go to Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org and get a copy of Ancient Words, or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. When we read the Gospels or one of Paul's letters, can we be confident that 2,000 years later we have what they originally wrote? The answer is a clear yes, and all we have to do is point to the facts. Find out what those facts are in my Bulletproof podcast this month. Look for Bulletproof on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Speaking events, new resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Post comments and interact with STR staff and other like-minded Christians. You can find all our social media connections at str.org.
With you here on Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel, and we're talking with Delwyn in Paris, California. And pardon me?
Oh, I was asking my wife where my Bible was because she left church before me.
Oh, okay. Well, we're going to talk in a general sense. I'm not going to exegete Romans 13, but Delwyn raised the question about Romans 13. I'm just bringing the audience back up to speed here about whether, since we have an obligation to honor the governments because they are, no government exists or authority exists that was not ordained by God, what moral obligation then do we have with regards to the to something like the revolution, and was the revolution appropriate? And some people argue that it was not appropriate. So this becomes then a question, a broader question of whether or not, I guess you could say, we could fire our leadership. And if because set aside violent revolution for a moment, the idea of revolt. Or at least the issue that's being raised here is that we are looking for a change of leadership Revolt is the means by which we accomplish it. But if God is the one who ordains leadership, then that person who is in leadership at the point is the one that God wants in leadership, and therefore we don't have the right to change that leadership because then we are be fighting against God. That would be the way the argument would go. And it seems to me that the change of leadership being accomplished by violent revolution is not relevant to the basic question of whether we can fire our leaders. If this
that's a different question, though.
No, I think that is.
I would argue that the violent revolution is essential to the question, because the comparative nation that we have is right above us in Canada. They didn't have a revolution. They got everything we got without a shot being fired, without loss of life. And there's some other things that, if we had the time, I've looked at over
that
100-year span.
Okay, well, that's a little different question about the Canadian situation. Let's just focus on the Romans 13. The problem with revolution, according to Romans 13, is that we changed our leadership. Romans 13 doesn't address whether a change of leadership is violent or not, and that it's okay to have a nonviolent change of leadership, but not a violent one. What Romans 13 says is that leadership is ordained of God. And so if we oppose the leadership, we're opposing God. No mention is made of means. So the question then is, do we have the liberty to change our leadership at all? Now, it seems to me that we do, and this is what we are going to potentially do on Tuesday. I mean, this is why we vote, whether we keep our leadership or we fire our leadership and get new leadership. This happens every 4 years. If we take Romans 13 to mean that the leadership in power is the people that God wanted in power and we can't change that lest we fight against God, then that seems to me it would draw into question even things like peaceful voting and transfer of leadership or fighting against foreign powers like Hitler, for example, or anyone like him. Those are people in leadership over people, but if we fight them, we are deposing the leadership that God placed even over those people. And on one take of Romans 13, that would also be illicit. So what's in view here is not just the morality of the Revolutionary War, but the morality of the Second World War, when we sought to depose a tyrant that was over his people and threatening other people. Actually, you know, Hitler never did anything against us. It was the Japanese that did something against us. We fought Hitler.
Well,
because...
reasoning here, though, here's where I have a problem with your opening line of reasoning here. An election is part of the governing authority. It's under the governing rules to have elections. So if you vote in a new president, you aren't going against the governing authority. You're operating within the governing authority.
Okay.
A revolution, by definition, is opposing the authority.
Okay, that's a fair point. So then the question becomes,
Now, the Hitler issue is a different issue, in my opinion.
He was popularly elected, too, by the way. He was kind of operated as a despot, but he was a despot that operated with the approval of the people.
If Hitler had been voted out of office by his own people, that would bring you the issue of Romans 13. But the issue of the World War becomes an issue of the governing authority of the United States or Great Britain defending itself against a hostile power. I think that is within the scope of the governing authority bearing the sword.
Yeah, but that wasn't the case
Britain
in the United
States. Itself.
Yeah, that wasn't the case in the case of the United States, because we were not under attack. We had by the Germans. We were attacked by the Japanese. We had a neutrality position with regards to that whole war. This is why they had the Lend-Lease Act, because it was how do we get help to Britain without violating our neutrality? And that's what Roosevelt's problem was.
Hitler did declare war on us.
Pardon me?
Hitler did declare war. If Hitler had not declared war, that would have been a stronger point. But after we declared war on Japan,
yes,
Hitler
responded.
War on us.
Correct. Okay. But we were aiding and abetting with the Lend-Lease Act, the Brits. We can go to all of that detail. I'm not sure if it's the most important thing right now, but let's just I do not think what Romans is saying is that we can never depose an authority that is over us. I don't think that's what it's teaching. I think it's teaching a general rule that the authorities that we have are that authority in general, governing authority, is something established by God, and that there are circumstances when the governing authority is not accomplishing the purpose that God established governing authorities to accomplish, and that is the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right, then it is appropriate for us then to rebel against them and establish authorities that will accomplish the God-ordained purpose.
But where do you get that?
From the purpose.
I can see there's an afterward.
Yeah, from the purpose of government.
After doing, you say, "Well, this is why."
Well, from the purpose of government itself, and this is that God ordained governments itself. There's also an argument that's given in the Declaration itself, and the Declaration goes into great detail about why they are fighting against their sovereign. By the way, if this carried to the kind of degree that you're suggesting, underscores the divine what used to be called the divine right of kings. If the kings are kings, this line of reasoning was being used to justify the authority and the unimpeachability of the kings by those in power at the time. That's the whole notion behind the divine right of kings. So that's something that you would hold to.
Possibly.
Okay.
Possibly. Given that when Romans 13 was written, they were not under a democratically elected government. When Jesus was doing his earthly ministry, he never counted. In fact, his words were, the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, therefore you do what they say do.
Right, but don't do as they do.
Just do as they say.
No, I understand that. But just look at, there are lots of things that Jesus didn't speak out on slavery either, and slavery was legal for a long time, and even then, circumstances were a bit different then. But the point I'm making is just because Jesus didn't speak of rebellion under those circumstances does not mean that it might not have been morally justified. And the Jews were under obligation to keep the law. They were in a Mosaic covenant circumstance, which is why Jesus told them to keep the law, because that was God's covenant with the Jews. And and they were to do the things that were appropriate for them while they were under dispensation of the law. So that strikes me as a little different kind of situation. Anyway, let's leave it at that for now, Delwyn. Thank you for the call. Good discussion, and probably we're going to continue to disagree on that, which is okay. Let's quickly go. I'm going to check my times here. 4:30. We got 6 minutes. Okay, we can do that. Let's go to Joseph in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hello, Joseph. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Since I only have 6 minutes, I will try to be as brief as possible.
Okay.
I was kind of struggling with the idea of propagating righteous beliefs mm-hmm. in an ever-increasing secular society.
Mm-hmm.
And this is of particular interest to me because if I could give my age, I'm only 20, so mm-hmm. I'm starting to see the more potent effects of secular views.
Yes, uh-huh.
And I was just trying to come to grips with how I can be the light of the world as I was called to be as a Christian, when so many people are clinging to, and more and more they're clinging to these secular beliefs. Like for instance, on gay marriage, I don't want this to take over the entire discussion, but mm-hmm. for instance, gay marriage,
same-sex marriage. It's not gay marriage.
Same-sex marriage.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Same-sex marriage. Right. And when people talk to me about this, their counter to what the Bible says is that, the Bible isn't credible and marriage was never really a religious institution at first. It was always government and social. Then religious kind of tagged along. And I'm never moved by that. I say, okay, well, where's your sources? Where's your proof?
Mm-hmm.
Because the burden of proof is on you. And not surprisingly, they usually can't. you know.
Right. And I don't make my case against same-sex marriage based on religious arguments or Bible. I make it on another basis, so I don't run into that kind of thing. But would you say that basically your concern is to try to get people to live a righteous life because it's good for the nation, even if they don't accept your religious claims about Jesus and the like?
Right.
Yeah.
And then because their secular views are becoming more and more acceptable.
Yes. Well, this is why when it comes to things like same-sex marriage, I want to make a secular argument. Look, if God tells us something is right to do, I think he's saying that it's right to do because it's also good to do. That is, it is consistent with the way that he made the universe and he made the world and he made us. Okay, so these are not just morally good, but they're good for us. Now, if they are good for us, it strikes me that we should be able to reflect on the way that God has ordained things to take place and see some of the good reasons why we ought to do that. And we can use those reasons in culture, even if people aren't buying our theistic grounding for it. And I think that's true in marriage. There is a reason that government gets involved in marriage. This is a question that needs to be asked of everybody. Why does the government get involved at all? What is the point? The reason that government gets involved in long-term monogamous heterosexual unions is that as a group, as a rule, and by nature, they produce the next generation. That's why they get involved. If that wasn't a factor, they wouldn't get involved. They're concerned about the family unit and children and all of that kind of thing. So if we start and we take an axe at the foundation of culture and civilization, which is the family unit, by trying to redefine it, isn't there a chance that this is going to have a deleterious impact on culture? That's basically the kind of argument that I offer. I think it will. And so I'm prepared to give a secular argument against same-sex marriage for people who do not understand that marriage is ordained of God. The reason marriage has the function in culture the way it does is because society, or rather the world, is structured in a certain way. Male and females make babies. Babies and moms and dads make families. Groups of families make cultural units, and cultural units make civilizations. We're the building blocks. That's the way reality is. And even if people don't understand that God is the one responsible for it, it doesn't change the way reality actually is. So, I mean, to go to your broader issue, I'm looking at the way God made the world and what he said about it. I'm trying to figure out how this benefits us when we live the way God wants us to live. And then I'm trying to communicate to those in a secular environment those things that I discovered, how they benefit us, so people can see that living according to the principles that it turns out comes from the Bible actually gives you a deep, rich, satisfying life and makes society better for everybody, not worse.
Okay.
That's what I'm working with.
So in essence, the best way to reach out to people who are becoming ever more secularized is to approach them from a quote-unquote secular position, if you will.
Well, when I'm dealing with that's one way, and it's sometimes I approach it that way, sometimes I don't, but I think that's certainly a legitimate way when you're talking about policy issues where laws are being passed and the like. On an individual basis, it would just depend. Sometimes I might say, look what you're doing to your life. You are destroying your life. You are made for something better. You are made for something more satisfying than what you're settling for. Don't you see that? So there I'm really arguing both things. I'm introducing the notion that they're living in a destructive way, but they were made for something better. So I might find different ways to try to work that idea in and stimulate people's thinking. So there's something for you to chew on, Joseph, in Indianapolis. Got to run to our break. Our 6 minutes are up. Back in a moment on Stand to Reason.
This is Greg Kokel here with an invitation for you to join with other listeners who are making a difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the financial support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Their gifts keep Stand to Reason providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Through STR, Christians can learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and winsome. I think you'll agree that our world, our cities, our neighborhoods need effective Christian ambassadors. Well, if you want to make a difference like this, would you consider supporting STR Radio today? You can make a gift to STR by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or you can donate online at str.org. You know, training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their values. And you can play your part in STR's mission by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate online at str.org today. Thanks.
Is science the only way we can discover knowledge? It turns out that not only are there other ways, some are more immediate and accurate than science. Find out what they are in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud, with Alan Schliemann. Find it on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids, simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric, clear the red herring objections, and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
Unforgettable. That's what you are.
Greg Kokel here back at Stand to Reason.
Unforgettable.
I love this song. And I think I saw that she's performing somewhere. Not him, he's gone, but his daughter performing somewhere in Los Angeles. Anyway, let's quickly get to Shreve, Ohio. This is Mark, and Mark, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing fine, sir.
All right. Hey, question. The gym I go to, there's one this Pentecostal preacher that goes there.
The church that you go to, did you say?
No. At the gym I work out.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I tried to start a conversation with him the other day. I asked him about, you know, I knew he was one this Pentecostal, and he kind of caught me off and said, he just said, well, look, he knew I went to church, and he said, don't worry about it. We'll all be in heaven. And he said, it's the same. We're worshiping the same thing. And I said to him, I said, well, that's the question. I said, I don't know if it's the same Jesus we're talking
mm-hmm.
about.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of just had a blank look and then kind of ended the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious. I mean, could you give me some input on that? What are they, Orthodox or?
Well, no. Oneness Pentecostals as a denomination deny the Trinity. Their view, as I understand it, is modalism, which this is a heresy from the second century. I think it goes all the way back that far, which affirms the unity of God at the expense of the distinction of the persons. So they believe there's one God, and there's no question about that. But they do not believe that there is a distinction between the persons. Modalism is the view that God appears in different modes at different times. So in the Old Testament, he presented himself as the Father. In the New Testament, he presents himself as the Son. And in the church age, he presents himself as the Holy Spirit. There is the unity of God, that there is one God, but there is no distinction of persons. There is no Father that is distinct from the Son, that is distinct from the Holy Spirit. And so consequently, this is not the formula. This is not comport with the formula of Nicaea, where you have the Father and the Son of the same essence but distinct persons, is the standard language we use. The ancients used language like homostasis and stuff like that. Some people don't like the Greek terms. That's okay. One God, three persons. Modalists do not believe, and Oneness Pentecostals are modalists, that there are three distinct persons. Think of it this way. And this is a standard illustration that lots of people use for the Trinity without realizing that they're illustrating a heretical notion called modalism. And they'll say, well, look, you're one man, right? Yeah, well, you can be a father to your children, a husband to your wife, and a son to your own parents. See, there you are, one and three. Well, that is one and three, but it isn't the kind of one and three that we find in Scripture pertaining to God, because the Father that I am does not have a distinct conversation with the Son that I am or the husband that I am. I am all that same one thing. There is no real distinction between those three things. Yet in the New Testament, we have the Father speaking to the Son. We have the Holy Spirit in the background. You have all three present at the same time as distinct from one another. So the modalistic understanding is not biblically sound, and it is outside of the pale. A person who's a modalist is not a Christian, because the word Christian has a precise meaning, and it means minimally Trinitarian. It means more than that, but not less than that. The Oneness Pentecostal is not a Christian in the classical historical sense of the word. And theologically, if he's not a Christian, then he has been wooed into believing in a false Jesus and in a false God. And the consequence is that by not believing in the right Jesus or the right God, then he is not benefiting from the pardon that is available through the right Jesus and the right God. So he will die in his sins. I mean, simply put.
Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. Is there any way to go about to help him see what kind of trouble he's in?
Well, it's hard for a person that is deeply convinced in that view and is in the pastorate in that view, but it doesn't mean it's impossible. Jesus said in John 8, unless you believe that I am, you will die in your sins. Now, your translations say, I am he, but the word he is in italics because it isn't in the original. The original simply says, ego a me, which is I am. And this seems to be clearly a reference to the I am that I am of Yahweh before Moses in the Old Testament. And Jesus later on in the chapter says, before Abraham was, ego a me, I am. And the Jews picked up stones to stone him with, because they understood exactly what he was saying. So this is serious business. This is not to be trifled with. The earliest testimony of Christians regarding Jesus was that Jesus is Lord. And they didn't mean Mister. They meant Lord in the sense of Lord of all creation. If you confess in your heart, if you believe in your heart Jesus, and Jesus is Lord, and if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you shall be saved. That's in Romans chapter 10. Isn't the implications of that statement, if you don't believe in your heart, confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, or confess with your mouth or believe in your heart that he raised from the dead, then you are not going to be saved? That seems to be the implications of that. So the scripture is replete with references of the deity of Christ as being an essential doctrine. And this is something I think that you need to address with, if you wanted to pursue it with him, this might be a fruitful way of addressing it. By the way, I can recommend, Mark, that I have a teaching that you can get through Stand to Reason, str.org. It's called The Trinity, a Solution, Not a Problem. And there's a set of notes that come with that that I think you'll find to be really helpful in seeing the biblical justification for the doctrines and for the importance of these things. So especially against things like modalism and the like.
Okay. You guys got that on MP3?
Yeah, I think that is available on MP3. You should be able to download the MP3 file and the PDF.
Okay, good deal.
All right.
All right, Greg. Yeah, you give me stuff. I'll go back and listen to this, and so it'll sink in my head. But, yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, nice thing about yeah, you're welcome, and I appreciate your call. And, of course, the nice thing about the podcast is when you're listening in and I'm talking too fast, well, you can go back over it a couple times. This is called the Curse of Knowledge, and I've been through it a bunch of times, so it seems easy enough to me. And it seems also that if I just rattle it off, you ought to get it too, but I know it's not always that easy on the other end. So the benefit of podcasts is you can hear it again. It's time to say goodbye to our Southern California audience. For the rest of our stations, of course, please stay with us. We'll be taking more calls after the break until the top of the hour as usual. But let me just say to everybody, please vote. Please vote. Make a difference. I'm Greg Kokel. Give them heaven this week, friends, and especially every day of your life. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcast and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.